The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Ladies and gentlemen, listening in the listening audience, I am Rick Adams, as you know, and the host of Rick Adams Uncensored. And my guest tonight is an old friend, or I shouldn't say old, but a friend of mine going back a few years. And he is Matthew Raphael Johnson, Ph.D. I call him Matt, and he doesn't mind. He is a scholar, and he has a website, former editor of the Barnes Review. And let me welcome you, Matt, to the program.
I appreciate it as always, Rick. You have one of the best shows out there. No question in my mind.
Well, I don't know about that, but I appreciate the compliment. It's good to have you here. Your website, I believe, is russjournal.org, is it, or .com?
.com.
.com. Russ Journal. That's R-U-S-S.
No, just one S.
Russ one S. Journal. Right. One word. .com. There you go. Russ Journal, and that means Russia, right?
That's right. Exactly right.
All right. Good. Well, now tonight, based on a column that you had published in the American Free Press just this past week here, a CIA regime change look to foment civil war in Iran. I mean, we can concentrate for a while on Iran and then branch off and tie it all together. So that's what we'll try to do tonight. But, we do have a break coming up in about another minute or so, Matt, and I don't want to get you started on the subject, but I do want to tell our listeners that you have time, ladies and gentlemen. You might want to access, if you don't get a hard copy of it, the American Free Press for this past week, I believe, of June 22nd of 2009. This current edition, it should be, and his column by Dr. Johnson deals with what's going on currently in Iran and why it is so important to pay attention to who the key players are. So that will be our primary focus, but you know, we can't talk about that without talking about Israel and the United States and Britain and, of course, talking about the entire plethora of people in Russia as well. So the whole world stage will be our subject as we move along tonight. Okay. And we are back now to begin the program. As I said, our guest is Matt Johnson, and he has a PhD. He has been certainly very helpful to us to understand the situation historically in various parts of the world, including Europe and the histories of World War One and Two, as well as the Middle East and Russia. And Matt, this column that you have written in the the American Free Press this past week, for actually June 29th edition, is very interesting. And it's what I've been saying all along, even before I checked with those who are there and who know the history of what's going on in Iran. You have the article entitled "The CIA Regime Changers Look to Foment a Civil War in Iran." And you basically contend that what we're seeing today is what Iran has already gone through with interventionism in the past, right, in 1953.
Well, to the extent that the CIA has been involved in that part of the world for a long period of time, the CIA has been a heavy presence in Iran since the 1950s. I don't want to come off here tonight as an expert in Persia. I'm not. I understand all of these things from a specifically Russian and nationalist point of view. But nevertheless, it's not exactly a secret that the CIA and its assets are heavily involved in the Muslim world. And of course, I think almost all of your listeners are aware of that.
We sure are. And when we say CIA, I like to make it even more pointed than that. I like to say the Mossad, specifically an MI6, because we know that the Mossad, and Israel's assassination agency, has to be heavily involved, and they have basically said so, some of the ex-Mossad agents who have admitted it, that the name of the game is to create instability. As much as we're told that Israel is, our stalwart ally there in the Middle East, and stability is what they provide, seems like just the opposite is the case, that instability benefits Israel. It benefits this growing expansionism on the part of the Likudites in Israel. And the CIA basically, not totally, but essentially works alongside them. I mean, that's been something that I have tried to convey, and others as well. Would you suggest that I'm wrong, or I'm correct on that?
Oh, you're absolutely correct, as is so often the case with you. The pattern is a familiar one. In the early 1990s, the main threat to the Israeli state was Iraq. Saddam Hussein had built a first world country out of a third world country, a tremendous healthcare system, education system. He was a popular leader. He was building a first world military to go along with that. Now, the second country to be in this process is Iran. Iran already has a first world infrastructure and a first world military with quite a bit of Russian help in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Syria is not an issue because they don't have a developed economy. They don't have oil. They have some old Russian refining equipment from the 1960s and 70s. So Syria isn't really on the map. Iraq and Iran, in order, are the two big threats, because these are two leaderships, the Islamic one in Iran and the secular one in Iraq, that has been transforming these societies. So this is the attack in Iraq, the attack now on Iran. These are major human rights abuses, because those two governments were extraordinary in what they were able to perform in terms of economic growth, in terms of education, in terms of healthcare, and even more creating stable societies. So you're right to say that the Mossad and MI6 and CIA, while working together, have done everything in their power to increase the loss of life, to increase the instability, and to make up anything to overthrow these governments, regardless of how well they functioned in the past. It's a real crime.
It is a crime. And, the question about invasions and wars has crept up again. We've been, entertained with the prospect of the Bush administration, prior to leaving office, perhaps trying to do to Iran and Persia what it had already done to the people of Iraq. And then we saw the Bush administration leave office, or at least that we're told they've left office. Now we have a new, fresh change, so to speak, and what we're seeing is more of the same, and a continuation and escalation of war in the Islamic world. And I think that's also part of the strategy. But doesn't it seem like this is a different situation now? Israel just can't go in on its own, or with the acquiescence of the United States, and just go in and invade and bomb from the sky and the land, because, a land invasion must take place. This nation of the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's not the same ball game. It's not as simple as it was in Iraq. So they have to develop a multi-pronged strategy. And I guess, what I'm asking you is, do you think that this whole regime change, disinformation, dissident voices in Iran campaign is a prelude to a war, a physical shooting war in the future? Do you think that's likely, or do you think that they're going to continue to work to do what has been done in the past, and that is overthrowing governments and instituting their agents?
That's a great question. I really can't see how the U.S. has the money, has the public support, has the infantry and equipment available for any kind of attack on Iran. I think that's exactly why they're attempting to overthrow the current Islamic government and install a CIA asset. The U.S. simply is so overstretched as it is that there really is no way that a huge, very powerful country, remember, Iran is the 18th most powerful economy in the world. She simply is too big of a target for any kind of military attack. On top of that, both the Putin administration and now the Medvedev administration has warned the U.S. substantially about interfering in Iran, and furthermore, that the Russians have a substantial infrastructure in Iran in terms of its scientific elite, in terms of its oil pipelines, as does Belarus, by the way. Mm-hmm. So the Russians have a substantial stake in Iranian politics and Iranian oil. For the U.S. to attack Iran would be the beginning of World War III. There's no doubt in my mind, because any kind of aerial bombardment would mean the killing of Russian scientists, of Russian military advisors. It would be a huge disaster for the United States. And let me tell you, Rick, every day of my life, I think we all of us need to thank God that John McCain was not elected, because I know for a fact that he had threatened nuclear war against Iran. I have spoken to some of his staffers who in D.C. who have said that he is very interested in the possibility of a nuclear strike in Iran. Mm-hmm. So that's really the big thing for me right now. Who knows what the world would look like had that lunatic been elected president.
Yeah, well, now with Obama, it seems to have taken, would you say, a different tack. That is, we're still trying to dictate to Iran and the rest of the world and play the role of world cop, but they're trying a more multilateral approach rather than a unilateral militaristic approach. Would you say that's the only difference, or are there other differences that you perceive, Matt?
No, I think you're right. The neoliberals and the neoconservatives are exactly identical in terms of their goals.
Right.
Now, in terms of the means, they do differ, and I think you're absolutely right. I think Obama, to the extent that he knows anything about the region, the people who he is very dependent on in terms of his knowledge, I think he believes the U.S. doesn't have the money or the support to do this, and therefore the next best thing is to foment warfare, unrest in the country. Ahmadinejad is a popular ruler, and he's particularly popular among the poor people of that country. And if you notice, when you look at the news, these are mostly urban kids dressed in Western outfits who are doing most of the attacking.
Right.
Ahmadinejad remains a relatively popular figure. He is going to be a very tough nut to crack. Rick, in terms of these color revolutions, the fact is that most of these, created by MI6 and by Mossad, most of these have failed. It failed in Kazakhstan, it failed in Belarus, it failed in Armenia, it failed in Russia, it failed in Uzbekistan. It only succeeded in Ukraine in 2004 and in Serbia years before then. So there's a mixed record here. They couldn't do it in Burma in the 1980s. It's failed more than it succeeded, and my personal opinion is that it will fail here as well.
Well, that certainly was to be hoped for, and I think most Americans, as you point out, would be only too happy to see that fail. I mean, the economy here is totally being decimated by the same clique, and we are an empire now. We're not in any position to continue or to expand it into another war, and yet we do have this Pakistan issue now that has taken a more center stage in the Swat Valley there, and we have congressmen telling us we may have to double or triple American troop levels. I don't know where they're going to get them from, but unless they have a draft. But, you know, here we are already firmly embedded in the one world system to our detriment and to the world's, I think. So you're right. It doesn't seem to me that there is any way so far that they can presage some sort of attack directly on Iran. It's a tough nut to crack, and indeed for good reason. So American meddling is backfiring against the world and not just us, the American people. There's no question about that. These people are wreckers. They're killers. They're masters of deceit. And hey, they've run the United States for a long time, and they still have their friends that are in Congress, no doubt about that, Matt. Well, I see the clock telling me it's going to be time to take a break. And a fascinating conversation with Matt Johnson, my guest. And we will continue when we return on the program with Rick Adams Uncensored. We're back now on the program with Matt Johnson, my guest here. And Matt, you know, we hear so much about this great movement from the mass hysteria media of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of demonstrators in the last week and a half or so. And yet, you know, you realize, as you sort of hinted in your commentary about Ahmadinejad, that, you know, that the fact of the matter is, whether or not there was any election fraud, and we really have no proof that there was, the fact of the matter is that Ahmadinejad is acknowledged to be, even by the hostile media, to be very popular in Iran. And I think the policies of these neocons have helped to make him more popular, and he certainly enjoyed that limelight to that extent. So that's one of the factors that, regardless of where one stands on Iranian elections, fair or unfair, we have to admit that Ahmadinejad has grown in popularity over the last several years. And another thing, I think, is that regardless of whether these elections were in fact tainted or, quote, rigged, as is contended by the opposition, particularly Hussein Mousavi, who is suspect himself as to where his funding has come from, one has to ask, what business is it of the United States to tell Iran or anybody else how they shall and shall not conduct their elections? What business, you know?
Well, the facts speak for themselves. When this election began, the campaign began last year, Western British and American polling agencies were basically saying that Ahmadinejad is going to win, roughly taking 60% of the vote, which is exactly what he received. Mm-hmm. The Mousavi campaign had representatives in nearly every polling station, major and minor, in urban and rural Iran. If there were irregularities, and there are in every election, there's no doubt that they occurred in the urban constituencies of Mousavi, as well as the rural constituencies of Ahmadinejad. The exact same thing happened in Ukraine in 2004, where both the nationalists and internationalists campaigns in that election both claimed a relatively equal number of irregularities in the vote. But as far as the Western press was concerned, only one side was reported, and that was a side that the CIA had openly supported with money and everything else. So the fact is that Ahmadinejad's win was predicted by the U.S. polling agencies, both private and state, even at the end of last year. So this is really no big surprise. They need to get rid of Iran. And by the way, it might be worth considering that one of the planks of Mousavi's election campaign is that we are going to ban Holocaust denial in Iran if I am elected. So that
tells me something.
So that, you know, like the average Iranian has any stake in whether or not the Jewish Holocaust in the 40s is accepted or rejected. That just proves really what this man is, who he is, and who's financing him. It's a ridiculous joke. This is something that he is, that he's promoting to the West and to the Israelis. His campaign, posters are all in English, which I always find interesting.
Uh-huh.
His Facebook group and his Twitter group, all of these are in the English language. Everything seems to be, geared not to convincing Iranians to vote for him, but in convincing the West that he is the man to support.
Yeah, that's a scary thought. I mean, we know from our own past in America how pandering to international forces and other people's problems has brought about this this terrible state of affairs which America finds herself in today. I mean, you know, the empire, the state of the empire is crumbling, and that's because of this meddling in history since really, since even before World War One. So, but I think it's interesting that Dr. Petras, who I'm sure you're very familiar with, Dr. James Petras, says that as he has written, the Iranian elections, they quote, stolen elections hoax. And his, you know, global research, .ca, and he says not a single shred of evidence in either written or observational form has been presented, to the effect that the elections were interfered with or rigged. And he did point out that there were competing demonstrations during the run-up to the elections, and pro-Ahmadinejad crowds were as large or perhaps larger than the pro-Mousavi crowds were. So, again, there is a very concerted effort on the part of the media here in this country, which we know is very friendly to the Zionists, to convince us of these terrible deeds that have allegedly taken place in Iran, provoking the violence that has unfortunately ensued. But again, when your job is disinformation, I guess the facts seem to get lost somewhere along the line, don't they?
You're absolutely correct. I am familiar with that website. In fact, I've been published on there many times. I'm a big endorser of that website. And they're absolutely correct. The fact of the matter is that there are major riots in South Korea pretty much every weekend, and no one says anything about that. Let me give you an example of what kind of a
I'll tell you what, Matt, I hate to cut you, but I see the clock again ticking, and I don't want to keep getting cut off by these breaks.
No problem, Rick.
That thought? All right, hold it. We'll come right back to you when we return in just a few moments right here on the program on republicbroadcasting.org. I'm Rick Adams.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Yes, I'm back. I'm back with Matt Johnson, Ph.D., my guest, and very happy to have him with us. Matt, you were just going to make a point that along the lines of talking about the media disinformation campaign, and please continue to do that now. Make that point that you wanted to make for us.
I wanted to give you an example of what sort of a man the president of Iran is. The fact is that this man comes from the peasants. He is of a low-income background. He doesn't like attention. He doesn't like a lot of media attention. But in the very beginning of this election campaign, he had a major Tehran rally, which was going to bring in over a million people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he said, listen, we don't have the ability to to keep some kind of control over a crowd this large. He didn't want people trampled. He didn't want the city to suffer with all these people. And so he canceled the rally.
Mm-hmm.
He said, forget about it. But that's what kind of a guy he is. He'd much rather be in his office worrying about the country and about the society than addressing these huge rallies. If, you know, the fact is that Ahmadinejad can outdraw Mousavi any day of the week, regardless of whether Mousavi has Mossad support or not. This man is immensely popular. This man has helped create a society that in almost every respect is of first world technological in terms of its infrastructure. And as a result, it's become a major threat to Israel on the one hand, and has become a major ally to Russia on the other hand. And the fact is that American sanctions have meant absolutely nothing, because the big buyers of Iranian products are China and Russia and India, and the U.S. could huff and puff, and it doesn't mean a damn thing as far as the Iranians are concerned. Ahmadinejad polled pretty much what the U.S. said he was going to poll, and that really just proves in and of itself the fraud of this entire thing. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind, no matter what, the basic constituency of this government right now is among the poor, among the rural peoples, among the older folks, military and religious circles. It's the real backbone of Iranian society. This small kind of yuppie class that supports Mousavi is predictable. And these are the people who speak English. They often have a British or American education. Mm-hmm. And these are the people who get recruited when they're at Cambridge or at Harvard, mm-hmm, or at Rutgers. Yes. They go back to Iran, and now they're supporting Mousavi. It's a fraud from beginning to end, and I think you're well aware of that.
Yeah, well, we just read the report posted on MSNBC about the doctor who was a friend of the young woman who bled to death there in the streets, and contending that she was just an innocent, kind, devoted individual, devoted to change. Now, she may have been those things. I'm not second-guessing. But the way he has orchestrated his comments from England, the fact that he's been anglicized, and he is basically trying to direct the thinking of people in the sense that he would like them to cast doubt upon the official vote itself, making it appear as if one of the militias was guilty, definitively guilty, for opening fire on this one woman protester who has become the poster woman of this media orchestrated circus, is just a little bit far-fetched to me. And it sounds as if, once again, we do have, as you say, these provocateurs who, for whatever reason, just happen to be in the right place at the right time. Let me ask you this now. Have you been to Iran?
Never.
You have not been there, but you know people who have, and I'm sure you know some of the people that went there, some of the historical scholars who visited Iran during that Holocaust conference, I believe, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Michael Collins Piper was there.
Right. I mean, and also there were a number of other people who, all of them don't come to mind right now, but some of the names do, and they gathered, and Ahmadinejad made it a point to suggest that this meeting was indeed unfettered, open to all, and I don't know whether he invited people from the other side or not, but I think he did invite Israelis and others to come and debate the Holocaust. Is that true or not true?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I was invited to that, and I very politely declined. I was also invited to the Russian one a few years earlier and declined that as well. But what is significant relative to your question is that one of the few Jewish communities in the world that generally are supportive of the government that they live under is the Iranian Jewish community. The Iranian Jewish community is small, but they're relatively powerful, and they support the government of the present Islamic government.
Now, some people might say that is suspicious. Why do they support it? Would you give us an explanation?
I think it's generally a positive thing. I don't think that Ahmadinejad has anything to gain by harming those people. The Christians that are in Iran are protected. They thrive as well. They're small minorities, and they have normal jobs and live a middle-class lifestyle. I don't think it's suspicious. I simply think that they do well there, and that there's no reason for them to be upset. So in this sense, the Israelis are doing the Jews of Iran a disservice, because if they push harder and harder and harder, it might be the case that certain generals or police chiefs within Iran might begin pushing the Iranian Jewish community, which would be a terrible thing. So the Iranians are not helping the Jews of that country whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I might say the same thing about Iraq. The Christians in Iraq did very, very well. Saddam Hussein had many Christians in his cabinet. Tariq Aziz, who was a foreign minister, was a Christian himself. He protected the Christians. He protected the small Jewish community of Iraq. there was no real friction there. The only time the friction ever occurred was when the Israeli government pushed and pushed and pushed, and then there was some violence, but that's certainly not the fault of the Muslims involved.
No, it's interesting. You know, I was reading the piece by Israel Shamir. You're probably familiar with him.
Sure.
And of course, you know, he has his own website, israelshamir.net. And, what he has said, in his recent column is Iran, all's well that ends well. Basically, he is saying, just what you have said here tonight, that the claim that there was some sort of wide discrepancy in the polling and that Ahmadinejad never was, accurately, reelected to his post are basically bunk and propaganda. And he does cite the Israelis themselves as being part of the problem. And he refers to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts' columns, concerning these neocons like Kenneth Timmerman, who just wrote the day before the election of a, quote, green revolution coming in Tehran as the, quote, National Endowment for Democracy, the NED, a CIA tool, has spent millions of dollars promoting this color revolution. And this was one of the parting shots of George Bush's administration, you see?
You're exactly right. The Ukrainian situation in 2004 is exactly the same. Here's how it operates. Mm-hmm. The National Endowment is a taxpayer-funded government agency that goes into countries whose governments that the neocons or neolibs do not like. They pay voters to vote for one candidate or another. They bring in computers. They teach people how to use the web, how to use Facebook and Twitter, how to use MySpace. They even have English language courses. They teach them how to put together a platform and how to put together debating points, even how to dress. Everything. Only to, of course, to the parties that the U.S. and the CIA supports. They have no right to do this, but like I said at the beginning of the program, they failed overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. For the most part, this has never worked. The CIA, they're so clumsy, these people. They put together these kind of Madison Avenue, guys in suits and with cell phones, and these guys don't really speak to the average person. They don't speak to the poor. They don't speak to the lower middle class or the rural population. They're simply an urban yuppie phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a smart thing that the Iranian government kept the reporters, from covering this because they weren't really covering it.
No, they weren't.
You know, they were given a script. They were told what to say, but don't underestimate the ability of the National Endowment for Democracy to what they call interface with reporters. That is to say, sit them down in a room and say, here is the line, here's what your editors are saying, here's what our friends are saying, here's what the smart money is saying, and therefore this is what you should say.
Yeah.
Now, these people are professional liars and frauds, mm-hmm. as you yourself mm-hmm. have said. It's disgusting. And thank God for the Internet. If it wasn't for the Internet, we'd be in far worse trouble than we are.
Well, and the ADL types and the Southern Poverty Law Center and other groups like these ones that we've just mentioned, the NED, would love to see the Internet imposed upon in a variety of ways so that somehow a hate speech is to be prosecuted. And hate speech is any speech that's generally accurate, generally true, which is generally in opposition to what the media reportage is of any particular day. So we see the ADL types drafting legislation like H.R. 1966 that would basically allow the federal government to come in and prosecute individuals who may have been found to have inspired some sort of emotional distress or harm to someone of a particular protected group, which, of course, you know who usually heads that top of that list. It's usually Zionists, it's usually Jews, it's usually Israelis and others. So the mere fact that we can still discuss these things on the net and provide accurate information that can be checked out is indeed a miracle that we have to thank the good Lord for that we have. But, my fear is that as they continue to do what they're doing legislatively, that it won't be a broad shotgun or blast approach, Matt, but it will be a piecemeal tearing down of our freedoms by these laws that give the federal prosecutors a
opportunities to pick people off one by one and shut down websites that they don't like. You follow me?
Unfortunately, I do follow you, and I have the feeling that me and you are going to be sharing a cell somewhere.
That's all right.
Yeah, so we could discuss this in some detail when we're doing, 20 to life. But the fact is that, this is a time for suffering. That's not necessarily a bad thing. We're a lot tougher than our enemies are. Our enemies are given everything without working. We have to suffer and struggle for every little bit that we get. We know that we can rip these people to shreds in any debate. Our enemies are soft. And let me tell you something. There are reasons, lots of reasons, to be optimistic today. The system is discredited. This economy is a disaster. Very few people take the media seriously. People by the tens of millions are going to the internet for information. Even though it seems that we have lost every major battle, even with that, we've done very well in all of these alternative methods of communication. And, we have a silent group of many millions of people who are willing to suffer with us. It's something that I'm willing to accept. I know you are and our listeners are, without doubt. But, as you said yourself, God will always take care of his people. He will always take care of us, and he will always give us a way out. And, during the Soviet era, the Orthodox people lived underground. They lived in up in the mountains. They lived in Siberia, and they thrived and they functioned with a tremendous community spirit that no one could take away from them. Suffering is not necessarily a bad thing for us. It makes us tough. It makes us smart. And I see no problem really in embracing it and just putting our faith in God. You're absolutely right about that, Rick.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to again reiterate what I mentioned at the end of last evening's program, and that is that there is so much that we should stress in the good news department that we often don't. And one of those good news items is the fact that this Professor Robinson, William I. Robinson, at the University of California in Santa Barbara, has now been exonerated as far as this investigation against him for the crime of, quote, anti-Semitism. Here's a guy that questioned the Zionist regime and equated it to the Nazi regime, so to speak. And, of course, the usual groups went out and tried to come down hard on him. And the university officials investigate him on these charges, and now all of the charges have been apparently dropped as of this moment. And there are a lot of people who are very pleased that it's a good kick in the pants to the John McCain types and the ADL types and all of the rest of them. So there is good news to report, and we should definitely stress that because we want people to see what their efforts do result in, that's the important thing.
Well,
efforts do pay off.
Well, one of the things that nationalists and Christians forget the real significant element here is that our struggles are never in vain, that these little victories that we have really do add up substantially over the years. The fact is that when you have tens of millions of middle-class Americans losing their homes and losing their businesses and jobs, I think that's not going to have any kind of political fallout is ridiculous. It will have political fallout. And so you have a situation in America right now where the average middle-class person is losing his job, possibly his home, and then he turns on the TV and he sees his taxpayer money going to support Mousawi in Iran or to send $10 billion a year to the Israelis, or something like this. To think that that's not going to have some kind of an impact is being very, very naive. Now, what the catalyst will be, that's another matter altogether, but still, these efforts will not be in vain. And like I said before, suffering is not necessarily a bad thing for our people.
No, it isn't. It does indeed help to craft a better, more disciplined opponent to these demons, so to speak. That's absolutely true. And when we come back from the break, I'd like to If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about, since your past in authoring many great articles in the Barnes Review and editing them, you might want to tell us a little bit more about the historical precedent in Europe and what's happening there now in the post-World War I, World War II era, if you would. So here we are. We're going to take a quick break. Rick Adams, Uncensored, with Professor Matt Johnson. We are back now with Matt Johnson with me, and Matt, you know, I know that you can't stay for the whole 2 hours, right?
Right, absolutely, yeah.
I would like to at least get in a question or two about, you know, I've done this World War II documentary, and it was certainly in memory of the late, great Dan Smoot and his educational campaign against internationalism and globalism and one-worldism and meddling, and I thought that it's so important to impress people with the fact that we've never been told the truth about World War II, and I thought I would help do a little bit of that in this documentary that I've made, and I know you've written extensively on that, and you have seen the various, you know, powers that be come down in Europe in 1 and 2, and basically lie to the world and lie to Americans to get them to come into the wars. And yet, you know, when you look back with your great expertise and knowledge and seeing the complexities of the issue, do you see any positives at all in America's involvement in either of these worldwide wars?
Generally speaking, no. As far as World War II is concerned, you know, the Russian nationalist point of view is very simple. Regardless of where you stand on the war itself, the fact is that the victory of Stalin, which ultimately is what it was, led to the slaughter, imprisonment, brainwashing of tens of millions of people. It's very easy to trace the slaughter of millions in Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union itself, not to mention Stalin's creation of the North Korean government, mm-hmm. and then the Chinese government then created the Cambodians, the Soviets then created the Vietnamese. How many tens of millions have to die or, you know, be recorded to have been killed, murdered, and in prison before people begin to reconsider the nature of World War II? Stalin murdered more than Hitler had even considered or dreamed about killing, never mind the mentality of Mao Zedong. And yet it's perfectly legitimate in universities across America to say that Lenin was a good man, Mao Zedong was a good man. It's absolutely outrageous, but it's based on the lies. And I think that the modern Jewish identity is based exclusively on the Holocaust. Without the Holocaust, there is no Jewish identity, there is no Jewish unity, and that's why the Holocaust has to be defended at all costs, and even more than that, other mass murders and killings like Armenia or Cambodia, all throughout Africa, they have to be suppressed, if not completely blotted out of the historical record.
Mm-hmm. What was your opinion of the National Socialist government at the time in Europe and Hitler personally? Do you have a moment to tell us?
I do. I have mixed feelings. I have mixed feelings because Hitler made a huge mistake. His primary mistake is somehow believing that the Slavs were beneath him. That was very stupid. I don't fully understand it. I think that has a lot to do with Himmler and Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that when he invaded Ukraine, and I've said this so many times, it's true, I know it by rote, but when he invaded Ukraine, he was welcomed with flowers. And you know, the troops.
Absolutely. Hang on for a moment. We just got a quick 1 minute break. We'll be right back to that thought. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Matt Johnson in just 1 minute on the program. I'm Rick Adams. Yes, we're back now, and Matt Johnson is my guest, but he only has a few minutes left in this hour, so I want to just quickly get back to that point about the World War II and Hitler and Germany and the Soviet regime and so forth, Matt. So you would say that
What was Hitler's biggest mistake, or at least the German government's biggest mistake of invading Russia, basically, you know, Operation Barbarossa?
Well, the Soviet Union defeated Hitler. There's no doubt about it. Hitler's best troops were ground up over there. But the worst part of it from the German point of view was Himmler's idea and Rosenberg's idea that the Slavs were inferior people. And Himmler is on record over and over again saying that the Slavs are going to be the slaves of the Germans when we take over that area. And initially the German armies were welcomed as liberators.
Mm-hmm.
They reopened the churches, you know, but it didn't take long for the SS to be sent in there. And for all of that moral capital, for Hitler to flush down the toilet. And he did the same thing in Serbia. He could have had friends all over the Slavic world who would have tore Stalin to pieces. And instead, he rejected them. He made enemies where he could have made friends. And really the biggest issue was, Hitler's rejection of the Slavic people. He didn't believe the Slavs were white. He didn't believe that they were Europeans. He believed that there was some kind of a Mongol race, which is nonsense, and that was his big mistake. And as a result of that mentality, Stalin won. And Stalin put his reign of terror upon most of the globe, and we're still suffering with that legacy. Tens of millions have been killed, and as far as the American academics are concerned, it's perfectly okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think I might hasten to add that Stalin would never have probably won were it not for American intervention by Roosevelt and company.
I think you're right, particularly as far as North Africa was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But when you consider the huge number of German troops and tanks that were sent to the Eastern Front, that really was the cream of the German army, not to mention the cream of the German intelligence. And I also think that the British in defeating the Air Force in the Battle of Britain also was very relevant. I'm not trying to take away from that at all. But the fact is that such a huge number of Germans were ground up in that meat grinder on the Eastern Front. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's insane to say that it was the USSR that defeated Hitler. The broader point is that Hitler made enemies all over Europe where he could have made friends.
That's very interesting. We're going to pick up on that sometime when you come back. I would like to mention your website again. How can people access it?
Real simple. It's rusjournal.com. R-U-S as in Kievan Rus. RussJournal.com. I have, you know, just page after page of material, Russian history, Christian history. I have a bunch of online books. I have two new books out on Diapara Press, which published in Spain, in our Spanish language Orthodox people, Ukrainians and Greeks. So it's kind of a big deal. And I pretty much give everything away. When my books are sold, that money goes to, there is a sick monk at the monastery in New Jersey, and that goes to pay his medical bills. So I get nothing out of any of these things.
Sure.
It's just a matter of giving information, and nothing is copyrighted.
No, that's wonderful, and you do wonderful work. I want you to come back again when we can spend maybe more time, if you could give us 2 hours, but that's up to you, and I really enjoyed this. So have our listeners. Thank you very much, Matt.
I appreciate it, Rick, as always, but you know, when you have little kids, it's way past my bedtime.
I know that, and bless you for your work, okay? We'll talk again, Matt. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Goodbye.
All right. Good night, Matt.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Run!